from the seven suns.
The Non-Profit. I'm your host, Dennis LeBay. We have a very special show for you today. In addition to our stalwart engineer, Matt Dillahunty, I'm pleased to announce that we have with us today the mysterious Jeff Jones of the Center for Inquiry, Austin, who has graciously allowed us access to their guest, the gentleman you've all been waiting for, a professor emeritus of physics and astronomy at the University of Hawaii, adjunct professor of philosophy at the University of Colorado, research fellow at the Center for Inquiry, CFI, and a fellow of the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, CSI, a man whose many scientific works include the cult hit KN Interactions in the I equals zero state at low energies, and the extraterrestrial flux sensitivity of underground and undersea muon detectors, soon to be a major motion picture. In addition to innumerable articles, his books include such singular titles as Has Science Found God? And his latest, God, the Failed Hypothesis, wherein he shows that one may not only knock the legs out from under the Kalem cosmological argument, but also savagely kick it in the nuts while it's down. This, of course, can be none other than Professor Victor Stenger.
Yay.
Well, thanks for having me.
This show is coming to you live on May the 5th, 2007, from Dillahunty International Studios in Austin, Texas.
Where most of the people are sane.
Yes. The music you heard was Ball and Biscuit by the White Stripes. The Non-Profits is sponsored by the Atheist Community of Austin, a non-profit educational organization promoting positive atheism and the separation of church and state. The ACA has weekly meetings at 11:30 a.m. Sunday mornings at Ventana del Sol on East Oldtorf, except for the first Sunday of every month when the ACA hosts its lecture series. Lectures normally start at 11:30 at the Austin History Center at 9th and Guadalupe. Lectures are free and open to the public. The notorious ACA Happy Hour is held at the Dog and Duck on Thursday nights at 7:30 p.m. For more information concerning any secret knocks or rubber chickens, you can call the ACA voicemail at 512-371-2911 or visit the website www.atheist-community.org. Now, you may be listening to this as a podcast, but if you're doing so, you're only hurting yourself, for since this show is broadcast live every other Saturday from 2 to 3:30 p.m. Central Time, you could have participated in it by logging into the chat room while we were live. For instructions, please refer to our own nonprofits page at www.nonprofitsradio.com and correct this self-destructive behavior. Now, I turn you over to Matt Dillahunty for any special announcements.
All this time and you can't get my name right? we're gonna cut most of the special announcements short, but I do want to talk about a couple things really quick. Tomorrow is elections for the Atheist Community of Austin, so if you're in the area and you're a member, if your membership's lapsed, there'll be somebody on hand to renew it. We'll be electing the 2007-2008 Board of Directors and that will be at the Austin History Center instead of the lecture that we would normally have. More information is available online. In addition to helping us out today on this program, tomorrow's Atheist Experience is going to be a special edition, so you can look for that on the Google video as well, or if you're not in the Austin area, because Dr. Stenger will be joining us there again tomorrow. I think we haven't talked about it too much. We may or may not open up the phones to him. Depending on how the rest of you people out there act, there's a rough crowd out there calling into the TV show. But I'm very happy to have with us as well today Jeff Jones from Center for Inquiry, and we're going to go ahead and turn it over to him, and he can tell us a little bit about CFI and what they're doing, and thanks for bringing Dr. Singer down.
You're quite welcome, Matt. Thanks for having me, and thanks for having Dr. Singer on as well. I am the director of CFI Austin. CFI, and its soundbite message, is that the CFI promotes science, reason, and freedom of inquiry in all human endeavors. That's the soundbite. Basically, what we do is promote science education, secular humanism, scientific naturalism, various things like that. We also have affiliates in PSYCOP, which is an investigative branch of CFI, which looks into paranormal activity or claims of paranormal activity. They haven't actually found any real paranormal activity yet.
Right.
And things like psychics and various things like that. Also, the Council for Secular Humanism, which its purpose is to promote the philosophy of secular humanism. CFI Austin is very much founded on a community concept, much like the atheist community of Austin. We have various things we do every month. We too have a monthly lecture series. It's on the second Tuesday of every month. In fact, that's this coming Tuesday. I'd like to take a moment to promote this. Dr. James D., who has spoken before the ACA before, is also a frequent contributor to the editorial page of the Austin American Statesman. Will be speaking at 8 o'clock at Amplify Federal Credit Union, which is on Burnett, just north of Breaker. Before that, at 7 o'clock, we'll have the CFI General Monthly Meeting. Dr. D's topic will be No Heaven, No Hell, and I Can Prove It. He's always a very entertaining a speaker, and I think you'll if any of you can make it, we'd love to have you there. Of course, our main event this weekend is that Dr. Singer will be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at Ventana del Sol on East Altdorf. And anyone who's in Austin, please make it out to this. He'll be able to go. We had a nice turnout at the book signing this morning, but he'll be able to go into more depth this evening. It should be a very entertaining lecture, and there will be time for questions and answers afterwards. By the way, I've never been called the mysterious Jeff Jones before, so I'm very happy about that. It was very pleasant.
He worked hard on that.
That's right.
Anything more than two or three syllables, take it as a bonus.
Briefly, we also have every Wednesday night we have our game group that meets at Thor's Hammer at 7 o'clock, which Matt keeps telling me he's going to come to, but never does.
Hey.
And we also have movie nights and other activities. You can see all of this at our community website at www.centerforinquiry.net/Austin.
Excellent.
Thanks for letting me plug.
Well, seeing as not much happened in the news, I think we should probably go straight to Professor Stenger and his new book, God, the Failed Hypothesis, which I read over the last 2 weeks.
2 weeks?
Well,
I
yeah.
I ate through that in like 3 days.
I only read when I eat, so it's like.
So it's food for thought.
That's right.
Well, my problem is when I read, I sleep. I can only get a page done, and then I'm sound asleep.
So why don't you start by, Dennis gave a rough history of, you know, your work so far, but if you'd like to go ahead and speak about that before we talk about the book, you're retired now?
Yeah, well, let me just say that I got my PhD from UCLA, and after having grown up in Bayonne, New Jersey, in a Catholic neighborhood, I was raised as a Catholic, but I went to Los Angeles, got a PhD, and then I moved to Hawaii, and I spent 37 years in Hawaii as a professor of physics and astronomy, where I worked in a very active research group. It may surprise people to know there's a big research group in Hawaii, still is. It's a major group that does research in particle physics, also astronomy, astronomical site. Mauna Kea on the Big Island of Hawaii is the best ground-based site in the world. So there's a lot of science in Hawaii. Hawaii is quite a center for science, oceanography, and so on. So I spent a pretty fruitful career there. I was involved in some major discoveries in my own modest way. I was quarks and neutrinos were a major interest of mine. In fact, the very last experiment I worked on before retiring to Colorado in 1998, I retired in 2000, but the experiment that came out in 1998 was the first evidence that the neutrino had mass. It was something that was done in Japan. So I had this career that I feel very proud of. I was involved in some of the major discoveries that led to what's now called the standard model of particles and fields, and that puts me in a position, I think, to be able to speak authoritatively from a scientific point of view about fundamental questions. I was always interested in, so I went into that field in the first place. I was always interested in the most basic things that happen in the world, what was the structure of matter, what was the structure of the universe, and of course thinking about supernatural issues and existence of God are all sort of part of that whole scheme. I think I'm in a position to talk about God too in a scientific way.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, I do a lot of talking on the news groups. One I frequent is alt-atheism, mm-hmm. And I'll point out to people that, well, yes, if a God claim makes a testable claim, then you can test it. I mean, if the claim is that any two Christians who pray can move a mountain from one place to another, then there's an obvious empirical test you can perform.
Well, the first problem I run into is this statement that science has nothing to say about God. Now, the amusing thing about that is it just comes from scientists. Or lay people. You never hear it from theologians because they claim the opposite. They claim science can be used to show the existence of God.
Yeah.
But scientists seem to be shying away from any conflict with religion. They're afraid, I suppose, that they'll lose their funding, their support for their funding. They become unfriendly. I think it's time for them to start speaking out.
Yeah, well,
and I'm part of that group, like Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens, who although Christopher Hitchens is not a scientist, but at least the other two are scientists who are speaking out against the type of religious thinking that has really gotten us into trouble, I think, in this country, especially with its influence on the policies of the Bush administration.
Well, who put forth the non-overlapping magisteria?
Yeah, that was Stephen Jay Gould.
Stephen Jay Gould.
He wrote a book a few years before he died called Rocks of Ages. And in it, he proposed that science and religion are separate, that they're two non-overlapping magisteria. Magisteria, I guess, referring to knowledge, areas of knowledge.
Right.
And he tried to say that science deals with the natural world, and religion is associated with issues such as morality. And most people who reviewed that book agreed that what he was trying to do was redefine religion as moral philosophy. And the fact is that most religions aren't happy with being moral philosophy. Because they have something to say. They all say something about the natural world, about that God created it and designed it and so on. Furthermore, there's nothing reason why science shouldn't be able to talk about morals. After all, human behavior is an observable phenomenon, and scientists can deal with anything that's observable. It's their job. So.
Yeah. What would be the... It depends what you define morality as. If it's the behaviors that allow humans to live together in peace and harmony, then there are objective behaviors that promote that, mm-hmm. and objective behaviors that detract from that. You can't argue with that. It's just it's the way humans are wired.
Sure, but in fact, that's a good reason why you can object to a lot of so-called religious morality, some of the religious objections to that they call moral are things that I think the non-religious would call immoral. If you're taking a condom away from some African, and that African gets AIDS, I mean, how are you helping that African?
Right.
Maybe the Africans may be being a little bit more religious by not using the custom, but you're certainly introducing more suffering into the world when you make decisions on a religious basis rather than what's a sensible, rational evaluation of what's the best thing for humanity as a whole.
All right. Well, among our listeners, we had someone write in just these last 2 weeks, saying that their pharmacist, I believe, is not going to vaccinate his young daughter on, I guess, religious grounds. He's a fundamentalist.
Yes.
And it's just, it sounds dangerous.
Well, my daughter, who has two young children, is furious about that particular attitude.
Uh-huh.
She says these people who refuse to vaccinate their kids are endangering her kids' lives because they'll be interacting with them in the classroom and so on. So again, you have a situation that's clearly not for the benefit of most people, and it's why do you have it? It's because people think it's something that came from God, and that's the kind of thinking process that we're objecting to so strongly these days.
We see this a lot, like with the global gag rule, which you referred to earlier about limiting what we can talk about in clinics around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're not going to give you money if you mention abortion. We're not going to give you money if you talk about condoms and safe sex.
Right.
We see that all the time, and people, there's this myth running around about militant atheists or fundamental atheists. And Dawkins has been labeled with it, and I've been labeled with it because I get a little too polemic on the TV show from time to time. But what I continually have to say is, would I prefer that religious people did not have those religious beliefs? Well, yes, because I would prefer to live in a world where everybody acts rationally, and of course I assume I am, so there should be some connect there. But I'm not objecting to them having whatever beliefs they have.
Yeah.
My objections are what they do on behalf of those beliefs, how they try to impose them upon other people to make everybody else live by their particular God-given morality, as they claim.
Right. The way in which this morality issue comes in my book, which is not about the social problems associated with religion, these other books pretty much cover that. My book is just about the existence of God. But there is an argument that you'll hear from theologians and even from scientists. There's a recent book by Francis Collins called The Language of God. Francis Collins was the head of the Genome Project, and this book's gotten a lot of attention, where he basically just argues that he believes in God because I've got this feeling of morality inside of me and of what's good, a sense of what's good and bad, and I don't see how any of that could have happened anyway except by God. And I say, just look at the facts. Look at history. Look at how animals have a kind of proto-morality, and humans, before they had religion, had morality. And then if you look at people today, there's no evidence that people who are more religious are more well-behaved than those who are not. And in fact, what you find is that people who claim that they use the Bible as the source of their morality really don't, because if they did, they would support slavery, they would support the subjugation of women, and another number of other things that you read, but they don't. And obviously what they've done is they've decided for themselves what's right or wrong. It's just the way atheists do, just the way the rest of us do. They're deciding for themselves, and they're picking and choosing where the Bible happens to say something that's they think is morally proper, then they say, oh yeah, I'm getting that from the Bible. But they're really not. They're
right.
getting it from their own sense of right and wrong.
One of the things that we see that demonstrates this, I think, really effectively, is they don't think back far enough. And that is, even if you were to get all of your morality from, let's say, the Bible, you still have made a decision in the first place that the Bible is a good thing. You've used your own moral judgment mm-hmm. to determine what you're reading is actually good. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to tell
right.
between God and the devil. Which one are you going to... I mean, you believe in both of them. There's information in, you know, in the book about both of them. But you're making a decision based on your own morality that God is the good one.
Right. You've used your moral relativism to accept the Bible as your guide. Yeah.
That's a tired phrase.
Well, you use your I don't think it's relativism. You've used your freedom,
right?
Mm-hmm. Your yes. free will to decide what's right and wrong, and then you've made.
For the most part, we have
an absolute morality. I mean, there's certain things that we just humans all uniformly believe in. Unless you're a sociopath, you believe that that telling the truth is good. What kind of society would we have if people didn't tell the truth for the most part? You couldn't believe what anybody said then. If people killed, if they lied, all these things would mean you wouldn't have a functioning society. And people have adopted this from, like you said earlier, from our own need to have to live together in a society.
Well,
and that's where it comes from.
Morality comes. We get our morality from the same place that people who believe they get it from the Bible get it from.
Yeah.
We get it from, we just admit, we just know where it comes from.
Right.
We get it from hundreds of thousands of years of human societal evolution.
Yeah, I think it's a matter of whether or not you've actually bothered to sit around and think about it. Mm-hmm. Some people are more willing to say, I don't want to think about it. Let me just say that it came from this book or say that it came from God right. or whatever.
Well, a good example is the Golden Rule. Everybody, most Christians in this country certainly, would tell you that the Golden Rule is the number one moral idea, mm-hmm. and that it was due to Jesus Christ. Where do they hear that? Well, they don't hear it. You won't read it in the Bible. They must hear it from the pulpit, their preachers who must know better, because if you read the Bible, you see that Jesus is saying that it's the law of the prophets, that he's not taking any credit for it at all. And indeed, if you go back in history, you find there's a golden rule in every culture. Confucius had a golden rule.
Yep.
Practically every major moral figure in history, not just those associated with religion, had already established that principle that it's that you should do unto others what.
It's a very common sense thing. It should be one of the first things that enters somebody's mind when they start thinking about how am I going to treat other people.
Yeah. Right.
It's common sense. And you know, I recently wrote a big kind of rebuttal to the Sermon on the Mount because I keep hearing from people who are like, well, even if you're not a Christian, you still have to admit that the things that Jesus said were really good things. And I said, no, there were some things that Jesus said that are attributed to Jesus that I think are probably good things, but there's a lot of stupid things in there too. And I went through and deconstructed the Sermon on the Mount to show where you're giving bad advice here and you're just plain old making up stuff in another place. It kind of gets to they look at the Golden Rule, they look at the Sermon on the Mount and say that this is the greatest thing anybody's ever said. This sermon is, I mean, it's just touched people for thousands of years. And it's not the greatest thing anybody ever says. There's bad advice in there. There's not some really good essential advice, like, I don't know, don't enslave your fellow man,
right.
you know, that type of thing.
Yeah,
this
it would have been good
exist.
If Jesus had said slavery was bad.
That would have been nice. Yeah.
He never did, though, and then St. Paul comes out for it very strongly.
Yeah.
Never condemned it.
But, you know, this basic common sense morality that you're talking about, the Golden Rule that you know has been in every culture, but people like Collins grab hold of that and says that's where God is. You know, that's what shows him that God exists. It's that idea
that
hardwired into us through hundreds of thousands of years.
Yeah, how do you argue with just bland assertion like
well,
that?
Well, you
just crazy.
You
well, Collins got his ideas from a children's author, so that's his major.
And his
C.S. Lewis.
The thing that convinced him was a waterfall that had frozen in three, and that represented the Trinity. I will say that Francis Collins has been, you know, I've given him a hard time, both on the wiki and on the TV show. But I will say he's been good in one sense, in that he's a good scientist when he talks about
science.
And he'll come out, and he has come out and said in interviews, he accepts evolution, and in the broad sense of common descent by natural selection, and he doesn't even need any fossils. Just the DNA evidence alone is enough to convince him that all life
must come
from the same place.
You know, there's a good, he tells an interesting story in his book about how when he would go and give a talk to Christian physicians, he would stand up there and he would say how wonderful it was to have follow the lead of Jesus Christ, and everybody's sitting there shaking their heads. And then he says, however, evolution is true, and all of a sudden the audience just starts getting up and walking out on him.
Whoa.
And so he has a tough time. It's a tough time, just like those Republicans who during the debate the other day, 7 of 10 of them said that they believed in evolution. I don't know how they're going to have to go back now and talk to their constituents. 90% of them who don't believe in evolution.
Yeah, and it would be interesting to see one of them come out and say, "You know what? I talked to Kent Hovind the other day, and now I'm convinced evolution's a lie." Oh, okay. So, how long now? I was familiar with some of your earlier work because I was a fundamentalist Christian until, I don't know, 2001, 2002, somewhere along those lines, and was preparing to go to seminary. One of the things that I did was I wanted to do a lot of research to kind of develop my own apologetics. And I didn't want to limit myself to only reading the stuff from Lee Strobel or any of those other guys. Mm. So I had gone over to infidels.org where I read virtually everything in that library that I could get my hands on. And you've written a number of papers that they've got posted over at infidels.org.
Yeah, that's true. They certainly are a major source of information. I mean, you can get use it as a reference to very nice work.
There were a lot of great essays in there where I was able to hear about things from real people expressing how their thought processes had gone on this. Maybe, you know, whether it would be a deconstruction of the ontological argument or something more along the lines of science and evidence for the current models of the natural world that we're using.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you'd written a book previous to this one. When did you start writing this one?
This one was started probably about 2 years ago. I finished it fairly quickly. I had another book in the works. Came out last year, Comprehensible Cosmos, and I was finishing that one up. And then I had one that came out in 2003, which was sort of the precursor to the current book, which is that was called "Has Science Found God?" And that was. That was actually in reaction to just begin the series, because I've been writing books on various subjects, paranormal subjects, about misuse of quantum mechanics, quantum mysticism, and so on. I have a book called Physics and Psychics, which was how physicists look at paranormal phenomena. But then, around 1998, there was a cover story in Newsweek magazine called Science Finds God. And I figured I had to answer that one. So I started writing, Has Science Found God? And in that book, I looked at all the various arguments that people were making that science had found God, like the intelligent design argument, like the fine-tuning argument, this cosmological fine-tuning argument, like the Kalam, cosmological argument. And I basically concluded that there was no evidence, that there was absence of evidence. And then people started saying to me, well, they even quoted, I think, Carl Sagan, I'm not sure, of saying, well, don't forget, absence of evidence isn't evidence for absence. And I said, what do you mean? Absence of evidence is evidence for absence. We don't believe in Loch Ness Monster or Bigfoot, because we don't have any evidence for them. Why should you believe in anything if you don't have some evidence, some reason to believe? And so that's what triggered me to start writing this thing, to say not only is there absence of evidence, which I think is a good argument against God already.
It's at least a good argument to reserve belief.
Yeah, that there is positive evidence against God.
Yeah.
That if you can formulate a hypothesis of God, a God, the God that most people worship, that has an important effect in the world, that does listen to every human thought, who is involved in every atomic transition that takes place in the most distant galaxy, and is responsible for every leaf dropping from a tree. Certainly that God, the God which I think most people worship, is the God that should be eminently detectable by scientific means, not directly if he's invisible, but by his effects in the world.
Right. He should leave a statistical trace, if nothing else.
That's right. That's, of course, the statistical argument is one of the best arguments out there. There's a book that came out a couple of years ago by a guy called Unwin, called The Probability of God, where he calculated the probability of God using Bayesian methods. So I recently went through that and recalculated it, putting in another physicist's estimate of what those probabilities came. And he had come up with a probability of 2/3, and we came out with a probability of something like 10^-35. So it all depends.
It depends on how you read those numbers.
That's right. They're looking at the same data. How can you get different results?
Right. Which shows you the value of that kind of reasoning.
So one of the things you've basically done in the book is, I think you did a really good job of clearing up the public, hopefully, if they read and understand it, their misperception about science, where they tend to think of science as a noun and think of science as something that provides a proof, and instead of looking at science as a model that describes reality and how you build it, and a model's viability is based on how reliable it is, how usable it is, and whether or not it's consistently, kind of reproved by the evidence that we find. Then you use that model, which it'd probably be better if you just went ahead and described how you're doing that, where it's not this necessarily the scientific method that people have been taught in schools, but a model to describe the world.
Yeah. I think that's important to recognize this word model, because people use the word theory very often for when they should be using the word model. And in fact, theory is a much misunderstood word. But basically what you do in science is you make observations of the world. In fact, you start with a set of basic assumptions that are based on observations. For example, time. You got to start with time when you're trying to describe almost anything. And how do you define time? Well, philosophers have never been able to define time. Einstein came up with the definition of time. And he said, time is what you read on a clock. And then on in. The rest of various observational quantities. Distance is what you read with a meter stick. Temperature is what you read on a thermometer. And when these are called operational definitions. So that's the first thing we do in physics, at least, is we make a bunch of operational definitions based on a well-prescribed measuring procedure. And then we make observations, and we make these measurements. Because you're trying to make it quantitative. If you make it quantitative, you're really 90% home because of being precise. And then you build these models to describe what you observe. And if they work, then they're useful. If they don't work, then they're not useful. And whether they have anything to do with ultimate reality, it turns out not to matter, as long as the model is useful. Whether or not an electron exists, you can still use the model to calculate the electron, the current flows in electronic circuits.
Right.
And it never does the metaphysics really enter into the issue. Another example I like to give is a model of the sun. you think of the sun as an orb that's going across the sky, and if you are a traveler and you're traveling from east to west, you can use the sun to guide your direction by head in the direction of the sunset, and you're heading generally west. You got to correct a little bit for longitude, but you can successfully use the sun as to get you that model of the sun is this orb going across the sky. Now, the Greeks believed that the sun was Apollo pulling a chariot across the sky. That was a metaphysics, and the Chinese had a golden bird was flying across the sky. So how does it matter which metaphysics is correct, if any? Obviously, we don't believe either of them were, but what it didn't matter what the metaphysics was. You still could use the sun in the same way,
and that's right, the purpose you're using.
Yeah, so that's the way it is with scientific models. We use them to understand apply them to for practical needs. And of course, the better the model gets, the more universal it is. It begins to be called a theory because you realize that it has wider application. One of the things that's important is that it have that your model have a wide application, not just apply to one little situation, but apply to lots of different situations. And the more general the model is, the more universal the model is, the more universal the theory is, the more widely applied it is. But it's still just a model. It's still a human invention.
Yeah, the example that I heard that I stuck with a few times when trying to explain it to other people is that we know the Earth isn't flat, but the flat Earth model is useful. It's used all the time mm-hmm. when we're building buildings because locally it doesn't matter that the
That's
Earth
right.
is
That's
a sphere.
Right. It's a good example, yes.
Now, but another thing, though, the theory of who's hauling the sun across the sky, the scientific argument removes intent from the hypothesis, where the other ones of it's a chariot that goes across the sky, there's intent involved there. The god could get up in that the next morning and decide, I'm not going to haul the sun across the
mm-hmm.
sky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they opened themselves up to...
Those Greek gods were very were very uncertain people to rely on.
Right. When you're working at that level, science
becomes the Iliad, the Odyssey.
Second guessing the supernatural.
That's right. So, you could wake up one day and the sun didn't go across the sky. That would happen in that scenario, wouldn't it?
And one would think it would happen every once in a while. One day he just decided, I just don't want to do this today.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think in keeping with what Dr. Singer did in the book, the fact that the sun hasn't stopped going around should be evidence that original model of a chariot being pulled along is wrong. Because, I mean,
right.
Does Apollo never get sick?
He's been on a lot of vacation.
I'm going to keep pulling this thing forever just because I like you guys that much. So you talked about you basically built up a definition of God in order to construct a number of different models to test to find out if the model held up, if the evidence was mm-hmm. supported. One of the examples that you used was the Duke Prayer Study, which we've talked about a number of times. You want to go ahead and address that about the efficacy of prayer as far
well. First
as a model.
Of all, yeah, let me make. Make it clear that the God that I'm talking about is this God which I call the God with a capital G, the God that most people worship.
Right.
And if I have found that a lot of the negative reviews of my book by theologians have basically said, well, that's not the God that I worship. That's not the God we're talking about here. Well, I still claim it's the God that most people. Mm-hmm. who are not theologians,
yeah.
believe in. It's a God that answers prayers, for example, to use that one example. Why would you pray? I mean, I think most theologians realize that God doesn't answer prayers, just that they don't believe that the resurrection happened, they don't believe that the virgin birth, they don't believe any of that stuff. They know that stuff's all nonsense, or just fiction, let's call it, rather than nonsense. Let's call it nice mythological stories mm-hmm. that probably... served some purpose at one time, as all myths seem to do. They give some people a way of understanding things that was appropriate for their level. And so when the theologians questioned the particular definition that I give, they're not disagreeing with my basic assumption that there is a God with a capital G that does things like answer prayers.
Aren't they kind of
then
just
those that
ducking?
That's a testable, that again becomes a testable hypothesis.
Aren't they? Do you get the feeling that they're just ducking because I don't ever hear them define what they actually think God is? Mm-hmm. The people who make these objections, they've lodged the same objections to Dawkins after his book, saying, "Well, that's not the God I believe in." Well, they never seem to define what they do believe in.
Some of them do. For example, let's take the problem of evolution and Christianity, which is a common problem. There supposedly large groups of moderate Christians and the Catholic Church in general supports evolution. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of scientists are afraid to get into too great a conflict with these groups, because they figure they need their support to have evolution continue to get to be taught in school. So these groups support evolution. So that means that the theologians have some answer to the problem of that's raised by evolution, which is that humans are accidents. Humanity is an accident. As Stephen Jay Gould had said, if you wound the tape of evolution back and started up again without changing any of the laws of nature, any laws of chemistry or biology or physics, you wouldn't have the same set of species we have today. You wouldn't have humanity because there was so many chance events that happened in the process. So that means that humanity is not special. Yet the Christian religion and most religions have always placed humanity at the center of the universe. So how do they cope with that? How do these theologians cope with this? Well, let me tell you how they do it. They basically go back to the God that Einstein didn't like, the God that throws dice. They have a God who just tossed the dice out there and then let them roll the way they rolled. And they say that, well, whatever the path took, the universe took, whether it went through humanity or whether it went through some other kind of species, it had God's intent, and God's intent is being his purpose for creating the universe is accomplished, whatever way it happened. So,
and so
that's fine. That's workable. I can't disprove that. That's what they'll tell you. That's the God. And then they try to make it consistent with Christianity. Because these are all Christian theologians, you wouldn't find Islamic theologians or Jewish theologians getting into these kinds of issues, and they then proceed. Oh, well, it's still consistent with everything we know from the Bible, and so on. Well, it's not consistent with what most people think.
No, what it does is
the difference.
It basically sets God's intent equal to the intent as if there was no God.
Yes.
If he just rolls the dice and lets happen whatever happens, then there's no reason to suppose that he exists in the first place to start the dice roll, except for the first cause.
What's the benefit of believing in that God anyway?
Yeah. Yeah. How does the Jesus character fit into that? What is he relegated to at that point?
That's a good question. I mean, I think they have to accept that. They have to say, well, it's another accident of history. But again, whether or not they believe in Jesus is not even clear. I mean, you take someone like Bishop Spong, who has a new book out called Jesus for Non-Believers. You read that book, and he tells you, well, obviously the virgin birth didn't happen. Obviously the whole story of the nativity didn't happen. Obviously the resurrection didn't happen. Obviously this didn't happen. Even there was practically nothing left that happened. and he's being honest. He says that he he didn't know this, but it, his years and years of study have convinced him of this. To be honest. However, through it all, peering is this concept of Jesus that he has lived with his whole life and that has brought him this feeling of happiness and so on. So he still is able to find Jesus as the name for something that he gives to account for the goodness of life, I suppose. But it's just a name. It's not anything that's based on...
There's a big disconnect
between
the professional theologians and the people sitting in the pews.
Mm-hmm.
And if we got them to comment on your book, I don't think they'd be saying, well, he's not talking about my God. Or if they did say it, it would just be a matter of they didn't understand it. Because you've gone through and basically outlined a model of God as a God as a creator, God as someone who takes an interest in human affairs, answers prayers, etc., down the line. And as I mentioned before, even with the theologians, they still get back to kind of a first cause argument that they still want the prime mover, if nothing else. So how does that fit in with the scientific view of the origins of the universe,
mm-hmm.
With this idea of whether or not we need a first cause in the way that they're saying?
Right, right. And I think that's where the argument always ends up. People say... Like, for example, when I say there were no laws of physics broken to create the universe, that was once a good argument for the existence of God, because it appeared that there were laws of physics, like energy conservation, had to be broken.
Right.
Well, now we know for a fact that they weren't, because the total energy of the universe is zero. No energy was required to produce the universe, and so on. So we have no evidence that the laws of physics... were violated, so the theologians have to say, well, then where do the laws of physics come from?
Right.
That's the next question. And then the other one is, why is there something rather than nothing? Well, I try to give answers to both of those the questions. In fact, the previous book that I wrote called The Comprehensible Cosmos was an attempt to show where the laws of physics come from. It has... And I wanted to do that as convincingly as possible, so it forced me to have some mathematics, which most people can't read. But the mathematical supplements in that book are at a level of anybody who's had an undergraduate science or math training, and anyone with like a physicist or some of the bachelors in physics or chemistry or electrical engineering or mathematics could follow that. And I basically show that I have an explanation for where they come from, that they are consistent with what you would expect if the universe came from nothing. Now, otherwise, I don't want to get too technical to try to explain what that is, but there is a basis for doing that. It's basically the assumption that when a physicist writes down a model, he's forced to write that in a certain way, and that is to make it in a way that it's independent of the observer. The reference frame of a particular observer, the point of view, I call it. I call this point of view invariance. And when you do that, it's incredible how everything falls out. So most people don't realize that yet. It's fully consistent with. I mean, I think any physicist reading that book would have to accept it. But you were not going to find physicists reading that book because what are you doing? I'm not interested in that stuff. That's philosophy. That's so. But I'll stick by that. So the point is, I have an explanation for that. And then, so the answer basically is that the laws of physics are just what they're expected to be if the universe came from nothing. Well, then why is there something rather than nothing? That's the next question they ask. Well, I return it and I say, well, why should nothing be more natural than something? Why should that be the natural state? And it turns out we have an answer from physics again. It turns that it has to do with the fact that in physics you find that systems that are highly symmetric tend to be less stable. For example, a raindrop will freeze into an ice crystal, and which has structure and doesn't have all the symmetry that the raindrop had. A spherical raindrop, let's say, has sort of spherical symmetry,
right.
And this ice crystal has structure. So there's a broken symmetry there. A pencil sitting on a table has rotational symmetry around that vertical axis, but it's very unstable. It falls over and it breaks that symmetry. So there's a lot of examples. Magnets are another example. So there are a lot of examples in physics where the more symmetrical system is, the less stable. And so systems will tend to go through a phase transition from more symmetric to less symmetric. Well, there's nothing more symmetric. There's no thing more symmetric than nothing. So nothing is, therefore, highly unstable.
And see, this is the point in the book where I had to reread a paragraph about five times.
Right.
And I'm sitting here thinking, because not a week before I had made the claim, evidently slightly mistaken, that nobody's positing that a something from nothing scenario. And then I'm reading the paragraph over and over in the book, and then 2 weeks after I read it in your book, Stephen Hawking comes out and does a public press statement saying, "Oh, I think that it's something from nothing." So, you talked about, and I don't want to beat the point home because I don't know that we're going to get anywhere. And that's kind of what I wanted to address. You mentioned that in your previous book that if you had a mathematics background, it would be something you could understand. And one of the things that we constantly deal with is how do we educate the public, the people who don't have that math background. Because I don't believe that religious people are necessarily stupid, but what we do find is that the better educated you are, the less likely you are to be religious.
Mm-hmm.
That's a strong correlation there. What do we need to do to make these issues more and more accessible to the average person, at least the ones who are interested? I realize some of them aren't going to be interested at all.
Yeah, well, we have to keep trying. I don't know what else to say. But that's why I would like to see more scientists get involved in these issues. They really don't, even though. So this same question, sort of more or less in the same form, came up today during my session at Book People, and I said, "Well, you know, I'm currently the only scientist out there writing this." And then people said, "What about Steven Weinberg?" Well, of course, Steven Weinberg's Nobel Prize winner, local boy. And he has written a lot about atheism, although I don't think he's ever addressed these issues, these fundamental issues that I'm talking about here. I wish he would, but I don't know if I ever had a chance to talk to him one-on-one on this, I think I could convince him to do it. But he has followed the lead of most people, like Richard Feynman and so on, in sort of poo-pooing philosophy. It was kind of interesting because in the early, the great physicists of the early 20th century, people like Niels Bohr and Erwin Schrödinger and Werner Heisenberg, all wrote about philosophy, all looked at the philosophical, Einstein, of course, I mean, they all wrote about the philosophical implications. But then the post-war people, the people after World War II, who were pretty much led by Feynman, really thought philosophy was kind of a waste of time. That you still feel that with most physicists, a kind of disdain for these issues because you can't test them, you can't go do an experiment to show whether one theory is the true metaphysics of the universe or the some other theory that we have all these multiple theories that seem to be contradictory, you know, like the wave theory and the particle theory. So that they say, well, let's not even worry about it. There's nothing we can do about it. But so you have them just, I think, again, failing to do their jobs of helping to educate the public and answering the types of questions that the public is interested in and wants to know.
I think we've seen an interest. I mean, you get somebody like, for example, Kent Hovind, Dr. Dino, who goes out and gives his anti-evolution speeches, big slideshow presentations, walks into the church, and basically passes out all kinds of misinformation, which, you know, I don't want to necessarily accuse anybody of lying, because I think that he probably believes it, but he's misrepresenting everything about science, about origins, about, he misrepresents radiocarbon dating, the fossil record, the geological column, and plays this up, and then proposes his own, one of the most absurd flood theories that I've ever heard, with the 40-foot canopy, which we've already proven would increase the pressure on Earth beyond anything that we could stand. He goes out and does this, and is basically, for lack of a better word, lying with pseudoscience. We see the same thing now with quantum physics.
Mm-hmm.
People just don't understand it, so it gets tossed around like buzzwords. In the, you know, we've had that movie What the Bleep Do We Know, and this thing about The Secret, and it all kind of boils down to the general public just doesn't know the answer, so they're willing to leap on the first thing that sounds good and sounds like it might be smart.
But if the general public was a little bit better in critical thinking,
that's it.
Even if, my wife taught English at the university while we were there, at the University of Hawaii. And while she did a lot of teaching of English literature, she also did a huge amount of teaching of English composition. And one of the things that she did with English composition was really insist on critical thinking, that students, when they wrote, whatever they wrote, they had to back it up. They had to back it up with reasoned argument and so on. And so I think the trouble is that she was probably the only one in the whole English department who did that. Everybody else, you know, seemed to just didn't care how people thought. And we need a greater commitment for the whole academic community to teach people how to think. Hey, that reminds me, I've got to tell you another story here that's funny. About a month ago, I spoke at the Air Force Academy, which you might find amusing, right across I-25 from Focus in the Family and Harvest Life Church.
And you made it out alive.
Yeah. No, but I was invited by a philosophy professor who had a little group that they have, because of the scandals that they've had there. They've had the sex scandals, but also religious scandals.
Right.
Because of the religious scandals that they've had there, they've set up these little seminars, and one seminar is a freethinker seminar, which has about 20 cadets in it, and it's run by this philosophy professor. Anyway, he was telling me this story. He said there was a student in his philosophy class who had decided to write as a term paper the justification for the Air Force Academy. Why the Air Force Academy was good for the country. And he came in one day and all upset. He said, "Professor, I just don't know what to do with this paper, because the more research I do, the more I find that the Air Force Academy isn't a good thing for America. There's so much waste of money, and the students that graduate are poor, and they don't fill in. Not that many of them become major leaders, and so on." And the professor said, "Great. That's just what I'm trying to get you to do.
Yeah,
to think about these things.
Let's go where the evidence leads instead of leading the evidence around."
So then I told this to somebody. I said, "Hey, where can I get a copy of that paper?" Well, it turns out that the kid still caved in. He was worried about staying on as a cadet, I suppose, and so he found some other reasons to make reasons of tradition.
Yeah.
To make the Air Force Academy
because
sound good.
Because it feels good and makes you a man.
Well, the thing that killed me.
But that's the kind of thinking. This is what the point is, that if you can get people to start thinking this way, especially young people. Really, we've got to work on the young people. Older people have their ideas formulated, but young people are still, number one, formulating their ideas, and number two, learning how to think. I remember what a great revelation it was to me when I went to college and started thinking straight. You get people to do that, maybe the rest will take care of itself.
Well, the horrible thing was all through my high school, it's like, no, I never had the scientific method clearly described.
Mm-hmm.
And so science classes were all just, you know, collections of facts.
Yeah, they still are. That's what's bad.
And it's bad. And when you did experiments, like in class, it was towards a preconceived conclusion.
Yeah. How was it supposed to come out? How many times did you hear that? How was it supposed to come out?
This is absolutely the opposite of the scientific method. You're not really learning anything about science.
Well, there are a lot of people out there trying to change that, but it's going to be a tough process.
It's always been done.
On top of that, you have so many people, so few students taking science now. That's the other part. How do you get them back into even showing an interest in it?
Don't you find that?
But that's why I'm saying that maybe the answer isn't in the science classes, but in the rest of the academic curriculum.
Maybe we could
critical thinking into it.
Maybe there could be a good push to add something to primary education that. Just a single semester-long course, an introduction to logic, something that starts teaching kids how to think instead of what to think, that they can take and use in the other courses
You need a separate course. You don't even need a separate course. Just try to
incorporate
get that
it into
incorporated into the whole.
The problem.
Religions won't.
The problem is that's exactly right because critical thinking.
You hide it.
The term critical thinking
don't
has become
the question.
Right.
It's become you don't make it on religion. You don't make the questioning on religion. You make the questioning on something else.
But the problem is, I think that the term critical thinking, if you don't use that term, anything along those lines, is immediately viewed with suspicion by religious parents.
Absolutely.
And they think, because they think that's where it's coming from. They think it's going to be an attempt to show the weaknesses of religion. And I think it's unfortunate, but I think that's why critical thinking isn't taught in school.
That's why so many people homeschool.
Right.
Precisely that reason.
They don't want their kids
getting
any
ideas. And then they'll send them to one of the Christian schools to college, and then they'll get hired by the Bush administration to run things.
Like all of the lawyers who've been hired from Pat Robertson's academy.
Yeah.
It's a shame that, I had a general average education. It's a shame that we would have to kind of smuggle in good education.
We're
going to have to smuggle it into the schools.
Hide it behind some screen that doesn't make it look like what it is. And hope that they find their way to questioning, to inquiry into those things that are the sacred cows of the world, like religion.
You're
like
sitting.
We have to concoct our own wedge strategy.
You give them the tools and hope they use it on the right things. And then
you smuggle it into like their first geometry course or whatever. So they're talking about the angle of incidence equals angle of reflection, and then you kind of lead them down a path to show that how this also applies to other situations.
Well, I had a colleague in Hawaii who ran a summer institute for teachers. He had money from the National Science Foundation to run this program every summer. And he would basically teach high school and community college teachers certain physics things, most of whom were physics teachers already to begin with. Various kinds of experiments and so on. And then these people, in turn, would go into the public schools and train the lowest level primary teachers, first grade teachers, second grade, third grade teachers, how to do little experiments in the class where the students were just discovering things by themselves, not being told what to do, playing with magnets, playing with electrical circuits. They have some of this in these science museums. I mean, my granddaughter, who's now five, about a year ago when she was about four, was in the science museum, and she put together this little circuit. And she was able to get get the light bulb to go off and so on. I mean, all on her own, just playing on her own with it. So we just need more of that, because that, even though that's experimentation and not thinking through theories, part of that whole process is the same.
Yeah.
Is the same. It's basically looking at the world around you and figuring things out for yourself.
Yeah, that just forced a thought in me there. The ability to recreate your worldview. Now, science can recreate, by observation and experimentation and stuff like that, the models it has from scratch. The models may not be exactly the same. I mean, they might have something else in place of the electron, but it will do the same thing. But can you imagine the differences that will occur if you try to reconstruct religion from scratch? You're not going to have what we've got.
Well, of course, you could try to get people to imagine a new religion, make up a new religion.
Yeah, but play
their role
of...
I don't know, though. We might be able to come up with something better than what we've got.
Well, that's true. It's hard to get something worse.
I gave the Supreme Court a little bit of... I've given them a lot of crap over the last couple of years. But when they ruled to allow the religious use of hallucinogens for that small group, I think it was in Arizona, I can't remember where, I went after them a little bit. Now I'm withdrawing that just because I think it might make that religion more popular. If you come to our church, you can get high. And it might pull some people away from some of the other churches and change the way, you know, who's pulling the strings for legislation now.
Well, yeah.
But the we mentioned briefly earlier that there was a couple different points, one about fine-tuning and then another about just the intelligent design arguments in general. I talked about Kent Hovind and some others who will lie, for lack of a better word. Then you've got the main representatives of the intelligent design movement, these guys like Dembski and Behe, who I have difficult time believing that they believe what they're saying. They're knowledgeable enough that they have access to the same information that the rest of us have managed to understand and sit there like crossed arms denying it. I remember during the Dover trial when Michael Behe was up there saying, well, I haven't seen any studies that or any papers that have answers to my bacterial flagellum problem, mm-hmm. and they present, you know, this huge stack of things. I guess you could talk a little bit about
what
you're
saying. Well, he obviously, I think he believed that he had hit upon something. See, he was, don't forget, Behe was, a biochemist. Mm-hmm. Not a, or maybe it's microbiologist. No, I think he's a biochemist. But he wasn't an evolutionary biologist, let me put it that way. And it was pretty clear in that book, he made statements about there being no explanation for this, examples of irreducible complexity that he gave, when in fact there were. I mean, he just was unaware of the literature. There's even one case where there was a Nobel Prize winner in biology who had years before provided a mechanism for one of, I don't remember the exact one now, I mentioned it in the book, one of the examples that Behe had given. And so the only thing I can attribute that to is ignorance. The same sort of ignorance I think that this guy Francis Collins has. I think Francis Collins is just unaware of all the work that's out there, including the theology that's out there.
Yeah, but they can no longer be unaware of it.
They just, no, because he's not going to, they're not going to criticize him.
Well, there's no, he can be unaware.
He's not
going to
get criticism from the people who think he's promoting their cause, you see. So they should read a book like his and they should criticize it. They should say, look, I mean, he's obviously not aware of the literature on the subject.
Yeah, where many of them are making an argument from ignorance, these guys seem to be making an argument from voluntary ignorance. They're not actually going out to look to find out.
Dembski, on the other hand, however, I think Dembski knew his business a lot better than Behe, and really was trying to cook up things to suit his preconceived ideas that were very, very dubious.
Well, that's really it. When you get down to it, it's the preconceived end they want to get to. You were talking earlier about how science will take a model, and I mean, science has a model, but if some new scientific discovery comes along that changes that model,
right,
and even drastically, it does. I mean, that's how science works.
Yeah,
the model changes.
Changes or dismissed. Yeah.
With religion, they have their model and nothing. Nothing. No
right.
discovery.
Everything has to be forced to fit into that
you
model.
You have to work the discovery into the existing model, and you can't allow it to change the model very much. And that's where, I mean, that guys like Dembski and Behe, that's what they do.
Yeah, they have the cart solidly before the horse.
That's right.
So we've got a little over 15 minutes left for those of you guys who are listening live on the podcast. We've got Jeff Jones from CFI in today, and they've brought Dr. Vic Stinger, author of God, the Failed Hypothesis, How Science Shows That God Does Not Exist. Brought him down to Austin today. He did a book signing at Book People this morning. He's graciously come by to talk to us here at Nonprofits. They'll be doing a lecture this evening, and tomorrow he's going to be on the Atheist Experience with me. So we've got a full weekend with a lot of fun. For the guys that are listening to the chat room, if you've I don't know. I haven't been paying as much attention as I probably should because we've been having a good time with some good discussion. If you've got a question, get it in quick because we're about out of time. We've also got guests in here, so I don't know. Did you want to ask a question at all, Paul?
All right.
Well, do you have anything else you wanted to talk about with CFI, or can we keep hammering on intelligent design stupidity?
Well, no, not really. Thanks for giving us an opportunity to promote our group. We are, you know, certainly friends of the Atheist Community of Austin. I was once the co-chairman of the Atheist Community of Austin, so we've got a background with that group and common goals and common cause. So we're very happy to when we bring a speaker in like Dr. Singer, we're thrilled to be able to get them more exposure and more notice through whatever channel we can. We hope this is a start of a long term thing where we'd be able to provide lots and lots of interesting guests for a variety of different organizations like this. So.
And there's a good chance that there'll be another guest. But I'm not going to announce that yet. For you guys who listen regularly, stay tuned. I'm waiting to hear back on potentially having another guest for another weekend visit, maybe, for Nonprofits and Atheist Experience. So we'll let you know about that. There's a question that I keep getting asked all the time that I want to make sure we asked you, because the one thing you've done in the book after you've established the definition of the type of God with a capital G that you're talking about and then constructing the model is you talk about the possible and impossible gods. And the question that I'm asked all the time is, what would it take to convince you that a God exists? So from your view as a scientist talking about models, what would it take to convince you that God exists?
Well, in the book I actually list about 8 or 10, I don't remember, observations that would have supported the God hypothesis.
Right.
For example, I think one of my favorites is goes back to Darwin. When Darwin first came out with his theory in 1859, he knew there was a major problem with it. I mean, he knew there were a lot of problems with it, but there was one major problem with it that he considered the most important problem, and that was a very famous physicist of the time, William Thomson, Lord Kelvin, had calculated the age of the Earth and the age of the Sun and basically showed that they were much too short. Basically it was the Sun's age. That the only processes that were known at the time to provide energy were electromagnetic processes or gravitational, and he used both. And he asked, and he said that the Earth, the Sun, just couldn't live long enough for evolution to take place. And if that had stayed that way, if that had, those had been the facts,
right,
then evolution would have been falsified. And we would be back having to find a supernatural explanation for life, the complexity of life. Well, it turned out that in the early 20th century, nuclear energy was discovered, and it was realized that that provided an efficient enough source to have the sun last for a billion years. And when Lord Kelvin found that out, he very graciously withdrew his objection to evolution.
Yeah.
And you could kind of think
that's
of any number of ways like that evolution could have been falsified. I can't believe it when people say evolution is not a good theory because it can't be falsified. You can think of it
just
dozens of ways to falsify.
Yeah, it's
the whole DNA story could have been different.
You often refer back into your book and say the universe would look very different.
Yeah,
if there was a God.
Another one was the universe in the Bible is a firmament. Well, if the universe is a firmament, then you don't have this expansion, which allows it for order to form,
right,
without violating the second law of thermodynamics. So if the universe had turned out really to be a firmament, well, then we would have proof of God. So that, on the cosmic scale, those are some examples. That's one example. And then we have the example of life on Earth. But prayers could be answered. Let me just think of an example from Revelation. If God talked to people, provided people with profound knowledge, then that should show up. Suppose somebody had gone into a religious trance and had predicted the World Trade Center disaster 100 years ago, and said they had done that, or they had predicted, or suppose Jesus had written that in 2,000 years humans are going to walk on the moon. All of those things would be examples of truths that could not have a natural explanation. So there are dozens of ways you can imagine where an observation might be made that would not conceivably have a natural explanation. I mentioned another example that I like is suppose that you had very well-controlled experiments on prayer, on intercessory prayer, and there have been a number of good experiments, but suppose the results had not turned out negative the way they have, but suppose instead they had showed that Catholic prayers heal the sick, whereas Protestant prayers, Hindu prayers, Jewish prayers, Muslim prayers didn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you would have no possible natural explanation for that. You would have to become a Catholic. Say, well, the Catholics had it right after all. Well, so be it.
Yeah.
The facts are the facts. The evidence is the evidence, and you have to go by that.
Yeah. There's a lot of backlash lately. You know, I mentioned the people who are making these accusations about militant atheists and fundamentalist atheists. There are people. There's even, as shocking as it is, discontent within the atheist community about atheists are, you're just being arrogant and condescending and all this other stuff. And while I think that some of that does happen, it's not. I don't think it's worth making any big issue about. From my point of view, we're not bragging about how much we know. I mean, we may know a very tiny fraction of what there is available to know, but we know enough that at this stage of the game, with the understanding that we have, you would have to turn the universe on its head to really make a scientific case for God. And any case outside of this, you know, anything else is appeal to, like, personal revelation, mm-hmm. which I can't dispute. I mean, if God's talking to you in your head, I don't believe you. I don't believe that that's what's actually happening. But that's personal for you. It can't serve as any kind of proof to anybody else.
The other point that I try to make is, why would a scientist object to finding evidence for God?
Yeah.
Good evidence. Evidence that met the normal standards of science. Why would he object to that? Because what it would mean is a whole new area of research opening up that would surely be well-funded, and there's nothing more important than research scientists. Let me believe me. I was one for 40 years. There's nothing more important to a research the scientist than funding.
And the people with all the money would be
funding. Possible for you to get all those toys to play with, all the computers, to go on these wonderful trips at government expense all around the world, and at nice conferences where you eat the best food and you drink the best wine and you sit around with all your comrades talking about fascinating things. What a great life that is. And here would be, you would become a god scientist and you'd have all this money. Why would you object to that?
You would instantly become the most famous person in the world.
Yeah.
Now, here's something that...
Why would you be dogmatic against
it?
No, here's something that I've come up with, though, on this thing. If you posit a being, a supernatural being, that affects the universe, and you can't place controls for it in any of your experiments, how can you... Wouldn't that naturally cast suspicion on every scientific observation that's ever been made?
Well, you could put controls on it. I'm talking about the prayer example. It's a controlled experiment, so I'm not sure what you're objecting
to. Well, I mean,
it's
the God can affect the numbers any way it wants to on whatever whim it deems necessary.
Mm-hmm.
It could do that just to mess with the
experiment.
Well,
it's true that you wouldn't be able to do experiments probing God directly by saying, poking God and the way we poke some particle and watch how it behaves. You wouldn't be able to do that. You'd have to think of some other way of
it's omniscient. It'll
well,
know
look, we do astronomy where we can't control. Astronomy would be a good example. We can't control what some quasar out there is doing. We can't force it into some box and say, let's look at how it reacts. But we can still study it. We can still make observations.
You can look at it, but it may only look that way because the God wants it to look that
way. Can you trust anything
that you see
in a world with
any observation you make anymore?
In a world
if something can mess with you that observation arbitrarily.
If you can't find any natural explanation for it, I don't know why you say you can't trust it. It has to be repeatable, I agree. If it's not repeatable, then it's not much value in science.
I mean, you could come up with a theory that, you know, angels push the planets in their orbits. And tomorrow the God could say, okay, take a break, angels, and boom, no more gravity. It's like, well
either that happens or it doesn't.
Yeah.
In fact, if you started seeing those kinds of happenings that seem to violate all known principles, that would be more evidence for God, not less.
Yeah. If consistency and uniformity began to decay, and we just started getting random results for things, that would be a good reason to think that maybe something else was going on.
Yeah, somebody that was poking his finger into things after all.
Yeah.
So the last question for the day, we're going to go ahead and give to one of our favorite people from the chat room. Do you think that Christian parents are actively promoting their kids to ignore science, especially when we're talking about homeschoolers?
Oh yeah, I think that particular group would precisely be doing just that. They would be making sure that the students don't get exposed to science. Oh, they'll probably give them a few scientific facts, the kind of facts that you talked about that you learn in most science classes,
right,
that don't do any damage. You'd learn how to build an electronic circuit, for example, without putting it, have it raise any questions about religion. So,
I don't think it's just homeschoolers. I think some
manipulating curriculum in public schools.
A lot of Christian parents tell kids what you're going to learn in science class is, you know, fine, you need to know that stuff, but, you know, we don't believe all of it.
Right.
They may be sabotaging the education they are getting.
Yeah.
You go there and you fill out the papers and you give them the answers they want to hear, but here are the real answers.
Here's what we believe,
yeah.
And I see that fairly frequently from parents. I mean, it's... it's a lack of willingness to accept the fact that maybe they're going to have to alter their beliefs a little bit.
Yeah. We saw a clip from the documentary Jesus Camp, which I've got over there, where they're doing the homeschooling and talking, and the mother's sitting there and she says, you know, science can't actually prove anything. Isn't that interesting? And she's putting this idea in his head that it's useless. Yeah. You know, where in mathematics you have proof and in science you have models, but when her interpretation of that is that science doesn't actually prove anything, therefore it's not reliable and we can ignore it. It boggles me how people can really have that kind of understanding in the world we live in today, where everything around us is a testament
to the reliability of science.
About how, you know, I mean, the fact that we're doing this podcast with microphones, with lights in the room, I mean, it everything is that way. But and it would all fall apart otherwise. Well, we've reached the end of the show. Thank you very much, Dr. Stinger, for coming down.
Well, thanks. That was a great, a lot of fun.
Glad to have you. Welcome back anytime, and we'll look forward to seeing you tomorrow on the television show as well. Jeff, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
To the guests and everybody else. Dennis, I guess you can close this out, and I'll...
Well, you
have a closing statement.
I was going to say.
Oh, I stole Dennis's closing statement. I feel so good.
That's cool.
Well, we'll see you all again in 2 weeks, and we'll leave you with the White Stripes.
Tell everybody in the place to just get out.